other relatives might feel a strong attachment to the fetus and wish to control its disposition, whether in burial, cremation, or to provide tissues for research or to help others. The notion that the hospital or the doctor may dispose of the fetus as they wish, merely because it is outside the body and therefore is waste material, is clearly unreasonable and inhuman. Similar logic applies to Mr. Burnett's cells. Even though they are removed from his body, he will rightly feel that they are still his. This is a natural and common human feeling. The feeling will not go away simply because the courts rule according to some other legal concept shoehorned in by analogy. You cannot banish human feelings by legal fiat. Yet this is precisely what the courts have tried to do. Some courts have decided tissue cases by considering the tissues to be trash. Some courts have considered the tissues to be research material akin to books in a library. Some courts consider the tissues to be abandoned property that can be disposed of automatically under certain circumstances, as rental lockers can be opened after a certain time and the contents of those lockers sold. Some courts have attempted to balance competing claims and have concluded that the claims of society to research trump the claims of the individual to ownership. Each of these analogies runs up against the stubborn fact of human nature. Our bodies are our individual property. In a sense, bodily ownership is the most fundamental kind of ownership we know. It is the core experience of our being. If the courts fail to acknowledge this fundamental notion, their rulings will be invalid, however correct they may seem within the logic of law. That is why, when an individual donates tissue to a doctor for research study, it is not the same as donating a book to a library. It never will be. If the doctor or his research institution wishes later to use that tissue for some other purpose, they should be required to obtain permission for this new use, and so on indefinitely. If magazines can notify you when your subscription runs out, universities can notify you when they wish to use your tissues for a new purpose. We are told this is onerous to medical research. The reverse is true. If universities do not recognize that people retain a reasonable and emotional interest in their tissue in perpetuity, then people will not donate their tissues for research. They will sell them to corporations instead, and their lawyers will refine documents that forbid the universities to use so much as a blood test for any purpose at all without negotiated payment. Patients are not naive, and neither are their attorneys. The cost of medical research will increase astronomically if physicians and universities continue to act in a high-handed manner. The true social good, therefore, is to enact legislation that enables people to maintain disposition rights to their tissue forever. We are told that a patient's interest in his tissues and his right to privacy ends at death. That, too, is outmoded thinking that must change. Because the descendants of a dead person share his or her genes, their privacy is invaded if research is done or if the genetic makeup of the dead person is published. The children of the dead person may lose their health insurance simply because contemporary laws do not reflect contemporary realities. But in the end, the Burnett case has gone awry as it has because of a profound and fundamental error by the courts. Issues of ownership will always be clouded when individuals are able to manufacture within their bodies what the court has ruled someone else owns. This is true of cell lines. It is true of genes and of certain proteins. These things cannot reasonably be owned. It is a standing rule of law that our common heritage cannot be owned by any person. It is a standing rule that facts of nature cannot be owned. Yet for more than two decades, legal rulings have failed to affirm this concept. Patent court rulings have failed to affirm this concept. The resultant confusions will only increase with time and with the advances of science. Private ownership of the genome or of facts of nature will become increasingly difficult, expensive, obstructive. What has been done by the courts is a mistake, and it must be undone. The sooner the better. Alex turned to Bob Koch. I think this judge had help, she said.
Yeah, could be,
Bob said. Rick Deal was trying to keep it together, but everything seemed to be falling apart. The maturity gene was a disaster. And worse, Biogen was getting sued by a lawyer in New York who was smart and unscrupulous. Rick's attorneys told him to settle, but if he did, it would bankrupt the company. Although that would probably happen anyway. Biogen had lost the Burnett line. They had failed to replace it with cells from Burnett's kid, and now it looked like a new patent interfered with their product, rendering it worthless. At Deal's request, his wife had come out of hiding and returned to town. The kids were at her parents' house in Martha's Vineyard for the summer. She was going to get custody. His attorney, Barry Sindler, was himself facing a divorce and didn't seem to have time for Rick these days. There was a big uproar over all the gene testing being done for custody cases. Sindler had been widely denounced for pioneering the practice, deemed unethical. There was talk in Congress of passing laws to limit genetic testing, but observers doubted Congress would ever act because the insurance companies wanted testing, which was only logical given that insurance companies were in the business of not paying claims. Brad Gordon had left town while awaiting trial. It was rumored he was traveling around the West, getting himself into trouble. Rodriguez's law firm had presented Biogen with the first part of their bill for more than $1 million. They wanted another $2 million on retainer, in light of all the pending litigation the company faced. Rick's assistant buzzed him on the intercom.
Mr. Deal, the woman from BDG, the security company, is here to see you.
He sat up in his chair.
He remembered how electrifying Jacqueline Maurer was. She radiated sexuality and sophistication. He felt alive just being with her, and he hadn't seen her in weeks.
Send her in. He stood up, hastily stuffed his shirt into his pants, and turned to the door.
A young woman of 30, wearing a nondescript blue suit and carrying a briefcase, came into the room. She had a pleasant smile, a chubby face, and shoulder-length brown hair.
Mr. Deal, I'm Andrea Woodman of BDG. I'm sorry I haven't been able to meet with you earlier, but gosh, we've been so busy with other clients the last few weeks, this is the first time I could come. I'm so glad to make your acquaintance.
She held out her hand. He just stared.
Cavemen preferred blondes. Anthropologist notes rapid evolution of light gene. Are blondes really sexier? A new study by Canadian anthropologist Peter Frost
indicates that European women evolved blue eyes and blonde hair at the end of the last ice age as a way to attract mates. The hair color gene, MC1R, evolved 7 variants around 11,000 years ago, he notes. This occurred extremely rapidly in genetic terms. Ordinarily, such a change would take close to 1 million years. But sexual preference can produce rapid genetic change. Competition by women for males, who were in short supply due to early death in harsh times, led to the new hair and eye color. Frost's conclusions are supported by the work of 3 Japanese universities, which fix the date of the genetic mutation for blondes. Frost suspects that blondes have sexual appeal because light hair and eyes are a marker for high estrogen levels in women and hence greater fertility. But not everyone agrees with this view. Jody Kidd, 27, the blonde model, said, "I don't think being a blonde makes you more ripe for sexual activity. Beauty is much deeper than the color of your hair." Professor Frost's theory appeared in the journal Evolution and Human Behavior. His research was corroborated by a WHO study that predicted the demise of blondes by 2202. Subsequent reports contested the results of the WHO study after a UN panel denied its accuracy. Frank Burnett walked into the starkly modern offices of venture capitalist Jack Watson shortly after noon. It was as he had seen it on previous visits. The Mies furniture, the modern art, a Warhol painting of Alexander the Great, a Koons balloon sculpture, a Tansy painting of mountain climbers that hung behind Watson's desk. The muted phones, the beige carpets, and all the stunning women moving quietly, efficiently. One woman stood beside Watson with her hand on his shoulder.
"Ah, Frank," Watson said. He did not stand. "Have you met Jacqueline Maurer?" "I don't believe so."
She shook his hand, very cool, very direct. "Mr. Burnett."
"And you know our resident tech genius, Jimmy Maxwell?" Watson nodded to a kid in his 20s, sitting at the back of the room. The kid had thick, horn-rimmed glasses and wore a Dodgers jacket. He looked up from his laptop and waved to Burnett. "How you doing?"
"Hi there," Burnett said.
"I asked you to come in," Watson said, shifting in his chair, "because we are very nearly finished with the entire business. Ms. Maurer has just negotiated the license agreement with Duke University on extremely favorable terms." The woman smiled, a sphinx-like smile.
"I get on with scientists," she said.
"And Rick Deal," Watson continued, "has resigned as the head of Biogen. Winkler and the rest of the senior staff have gone with him. Most of them face legal troubles, and I am sad the company will not be able to assist them. If you break the law, the company's insurance policy does not cover you, so they're on their own."
"Unfortunate,"
Jacqueline Maurer said.
"So it goes," Watson said.
"But given the present crisis, the Biogen Board of Directors has asked me to take over and put the company back on its feet. I have agreed to do so for an appropriate equity adjustment."
Burnett nodded. "Then it all went according to plan."
Watson gave him an odd look.
Yes.
"In any case, Frank, nothing more prevents you from returning home to your family. I'm sure your daughter and grandson will be happy to see you."
"I hope so," Burnett said. "She's probably angry, but it'll work out. It always does."
"That's right," Watson said. Still seated, he extended his hand, wincing a little.
"Everything all right?" Frank said.
"It's nothing. Too much golf yesterday. I pulled something."
"But it's good to take time off from work."
"So true," Watson said, flashing his famous smile. "So very true."
Brad Gordon followed the crowds that swarmed toward Mighty Kong, the huge roller coaster at Cedar Point in Sandusky, Ohio. He'd been visiting amusement parks for weeks now. This was the biggest and best in America. He was feeling better. His jaw was almost completely pain-free now. The only thing that bothered him was he had had one conversation with his lawyer, Johnson. Johnson seemed smart, but Brad was uneasy. Why hadn't his uncle paid for a first-rate attorney? He always had before. Brad had the vague feeling that his life was on some sort of knife edge. But he pushed all those thoughts aside as he looked at the track far above him and the people shrieking as their cars went by. This roller coaster, Mighty Kong, with more than 400 feet of drop, it gave plenty of cause for people to scream. The line of eager ticket holders buzzed with anticipation. Brad waited, as was his custom, until two very cute young girls got online. They were local kids, raised in a milk bottle, healthy and pink-skinned, with little budding breasts and sweet faces. One girl had braces, which was just adorable. He stayed behind them, happily listening to their high-pitched, inane chatter. Then he screamed with the rest of them as he took the fantastic drop. The ride left him shivering with adrenaline and pent-up excitement. He felt a bit weak as he climbed out of the car and watched the girls' round little buns as they walked away from the coaster toward the exit. Wait! They were going again. Perfect! He followed them, getting online a second time. He was feeling dreamy, catching his breath, letting his eyes drift over the soft curls of their hair, the freckles on their shoulders revealed by their halter tops. He was starting to fantasize about what it would be like with one of them. Hell, with both of them. When a man stepped forward and said, "Come with me, please." Brad blinked, guilty from his reverie. "I'm sorry? Would you come with me, sir?" It was a handsome, confident face, one encouraging him, smiling. Brad was instantly suspicious. Often cops acted friendly and polite. He hadn't done anything with these girls, he was sure of it. He hadn't touched them, hadn't said anything. "Sir, please, it's important if you would step over here. Just over here." Brad looked and saw, to one side, some people wearing what appeared to be uniforms, maybe security uniforms, and a couple of men in white coats, like people from a sanitarium. And there was a television crew, or a camera crew of some kind, filming. And he suddenly felt paranoid. "Sir," the handsome man said, "please, we very much need you. Why do you need me?" "Sir, please." The man was plucking at Brad's elbow, then grabbed it more forcefully. "Sir, we get so few adult repeaters." Adult repeaters, Brad shivered. They knew. And now this guy, this handsome, charming, smooth talker, was leading him toward the people in the white coats. They were obviously onto him, and he tugged free. But the handsome man held on. Brad's heart was pounding, and he felt panic flood through him. He bent over and pulled his gun from its holster. "No, let go of me!" The handsome man looked shocked. Some people screamed. The man held up his hands. "Now, take it easy," he said. "It's going to be..." The gun in Brad's hand fired. He didn't realize it had happened until he saw the man stumble and start to fall. He clutched at Brad, hanging on him, and Brad shot again. The man fell back. Everybody was screaming all over the place. Somebody shouted, "He shot Dr. Bellarmino! He shot Bellarmino!" But by then he was very confused. The crowd was running away. Those cute little buns were running. Everything was ruined. And when more men in uniform yelled to him to drop his gun, he fired at them, too. And the world went black. At the fall meeting of the Organization of University Technology Transfer Officers, OUTT, a group dedicated to licensing the work of university scientists, philanthropist Jack B. Watson gave the stirring keynote address. He struck his familiar themes, the spectacular growth of biotechnology,
the importance of gene patents, keeping Bayh-Dole in place, and the necessity of preserving the status quo for business prosperity and university wealth. The health and wealth of our universities depends on strong biotech partners. This is the key to knowledge, and the key to the future. He told them what they wanted to hear, and left the stage to the usual thunderous applause. Only a few noticed that he walked with a slight limp, and that his right arm did not swing as freely as the left. Backstage he took the arm of a beautiful woman. "Where the hell is Dr. Robbins?"
"He's waiting for you in his clinic," she said.
Watson swore, then leaned on the woman as he walked outside to the waiting limousine. The night was cold with a faint mist. "Fucking doctors," he said. "I'm not doing any more damn tests."
Dr. Robbins didn't mention anything about tests.
The driver opened the door. Watson climbed in awkwardly, his leg dragging. The woman helped him in. He slumped in the back, wincing. The woman got in on the other side.
"Is the pain bad?"
"It's worse at night."
"Do you want a pill?"
"I already took one." He inhaled deeply. "Does Robbins know what the hell this is?"
"I think so."
"Did he tell you?"
"No."
"You're lying."
"He didn't tell me, Jack."
"Christ." The limousine sped through the night. Watson stared out the window, breathing hard. The hospital clinic was deserted at this hour. Fred Robbins, 35 and handsome as a movie star, was waiting for Watson with two younger physicians in a large examining room. Robbins had set up light boxes with X-ray, electrophoresis, and MRI results. Watson dropped heavily into a chair. He waved to the younger men.
"You can go."
"But Jack..."
"Tell me alone," Watson said to Robbins. 19 fucking doctors have examined me in the last 2 months. I've done so many MRIs and CAT scans I glow in the dark. You tell me." He waved to the woman. "You wait outside, too."
They all left. Watson was alone with Robbins. "They say you're the smartest diagnostician in America, Fred. So tell me."
"Well," Robbins said, "it's as much a biochemical process as anything. That's why I wanted..."
3 months ago," Watson said, "I had a pain in my leg. A week later, the leg was dragging. My shoe was worn at the edge. Pretty soon I had trouble walking upstairs. Now I have weakness in my right arm. Can't squeeze toothpaste with my hand. It's getting hard to breathe. In 3 months. So tell me."
"It's called Vogelmann's paresis," Robbins said. "It's not common, but not rare. A few thousand cases every year, maybe 50,000 worldwide. First described in the 1890s by a French..."
"Can you treat it?"
"At this point," Robbins said, "there are no satisfactory treatments."
"Are there any treatments?"
"Palliative and supportive measures, massage and B vitamins..."
"But no treatments?"
"Not really, Jack. No."
"What causes it?"
"That we know. 5 years ago, Ender's team at Scripps isolated a gene, BRD7A, that codes for a protein that repairs myelin around nerve cells. They've demonstrated that a point mutation in the gene produces Vogelmann's paresis in animals."
"Well, hell," Watson said. "You're telling me I've got a genetic deficiency disease like any other."
"Yes, but..."
"How long ago did they find the gene? 5 years? Then it's a natural for gene replacement. Start the coded protein being made inside the body."
"Replacement therapy is risky, of course."
"Do I give a damn? Look at me, Fred. How much time do I have?"
"The time course is variable, but..."
"Spit it out."
"Maybe 4 months."
"Jesus."
Watson sucked in his breath. He ran his hand over his forehead, took another breath.
"Okay. So that's my situation. Let's do the therapy. 5 years later, they must have a protocol."
They don't,
Robin said.
Well, somebody must.
They don't. Scripps patented the gene and licensed it to Beinart Baghoff, the Swiss pharma giant. It was part of a package deal with Scripps, about 20 different collaborations. BRD7A wasn't regarded as particularly important.
What are you saying?
Beinart put a high license fee on the gene.
Why? It's an orphan disease. It makes no sense to...
Robin shrugged.
They're a big company. Who knows why they do things? Their licensing division sets fees for 800 genes that they control. There's 40 people in that division. It's a bureaucracy. Anyway, they set the license high.
Christ.
And no laboratory anywhere in the world has worked on the disease in the last 5 years.
Christ.
Too expensive, Jack.
Then I'll buy the damn gene.
Can't. I already checked. It's not for sale.
Everything's for sale.
Any sale by Beinart has to be approved by Scripps, and the Scripps Office of Tech Transfer won't consider...
Never mind. I'll license it myself.
You can do that, yes?
And I'll set up the gene transfer myself. We'll get a team in this hospital to do it.
I really wish we could, Jack. But gene transfer is extremely risky, and no lab will take the chance these days. Nobody's gone to jail yet over a failed gene transfer, but there have been a lot of patient deaths, and
Fred, look at me.
You can get it done in Shanghai.
No, no, here.
Fred Robbins bit his lip.
Jack, you have to face reality. There's less than a 1% success rate. I mean, if we had done 5 years of work, we would have the results of animal tests, vector tests, immunosuppressive protocols, all kinds of steps to increase your chance of success. But just shooting from the hip...
That's all I have time for. Shooting from the hip.
Fred Robbins was shaking his head.
$100 million. Watson said, for whatever lab does it. Take over a private clinic out in Arcadia. Just me. Nobody knows. Do the procedure there. It works or it doesn't.
Fred Robbins shook his head sadly.
I'm sorry, Jack. I really am.
The overhead lights came on in the autopsy room, bank after bank. It made a dramatic opening shot, Gourevitch thought. The figure in the lab coat was distinguished-looking in a severe way, silver hair, wire-rim glasses. He was the internationally renowned primate anatomist Jörg Ericsson. Using a handheld camera, Gourevitch said,
Dr. Ericsson, what are we doing today?
We are examining a world-famous specimen, the putative talking orangutan of Indonesia. This animal is said to have spoken in at least 2 languages. Well, we shall see.
Dr. Ericsson turned to the steel table, where the carcass was draped in a white cloth. He pulled the cloth away with a flourish.
This is a sub-adult or juvenile Pongo abeli, a Sumatran orangutan, distinguished by its smaller size from the Borneo orangutan. This specimen is male, approximately 3 years of age, in apparent good health, with no external scars or injuries. All right, now we begin.
He picked up a scalpel.
With a mid-sagittal incision, I expose the anterior musculature of the throat and pharynx. Note the superior and inferior belly of the omohyoid, and here the sternohyoid.
Ericsson was bent over the animal's neck. Gourevitch found it difficult to maneuver for a shot.
What do you see, Professor?
I am looking now at the stylohyoid and the cricothyroid muscles here and here. And this is quite interesting. Ordinarily in Pongo, we find the anterior musculature poorly developed and lacking the fine motor control of the human speech apparatus.
But this creature appears to be a transitional case, bearing some features of the classic pongid pharynx, and some features more characteristic of the human neck. Notice the sternocleidomastoid.
Gorovitch thought, sternocleidomastoid? Jesus! They would have to dub in a voiceover.
Professor, perhaps you could say it in English?
No, the terms are Latin. I don't know the translation.
I mean, can you explain in layman's terms for our viewers?
Ah, of course. All these superficial muscles, most of which attach to the hyoid, that is to say, the Adam's apple, these muscles are more human than ape-like.
What could account for that?
Some mutation, obviously.
And the rest of the animal? Is it more human as well?
I have not seen the rest of the animal, Erickson said severely, but we will get there in due time. I shall be especially interested to inspect any rotation of the axis of the foramen magnum, and of course the depth and arrangement of sulci of the motor cortex, to the extent that gray matter has been preserved.
Do you expect to find human-like changes in the brain?
Frankly, no, I do not,
Erickson said. He turned his attention to the top of the skull, running his gloved hands over the sparse hair of the orang's scalp, feeling the bones beneath.
You see, in this animal, parietal bones slope inward, toward the top of the cranium. That is a classic pongid or chimp finding, whereas humans have bulging parietal bones. The top of their heads are wider than the bottom.
Erickson stepped back from the table. Gorovitch said,
So you are saying this animal is a mixture of human and ape?
No, Erickson said. This is an ape. It is an aberrant ape, to be sure, but it is merely an ape.
John B. Watson Investment Group for immediate release. John B. Jack Watson, world-famous philanthropist and founder of the Watson Investment Group, died today in Shanghai, China. Mr. Watson was internationally lauded for his charitable work and his efforts on behalf of the poor and downtrodden of the world. Mr. Watson had been ill for only a short time, but he suffered from an extremely aggressive form of cancer. He checked into a private Shanghai clinic and died 3 days later. He is mourned by friends and colleagues around the world. Story details to come. Henry Kendall was surprised that Gerard could help Dave with his math homework, but that wouldn't last long. Eventually, Dave would probably need special schooling. Dave had inherited the chimp's short attention span. He found it increasingly difficult to keep up with the other kids in class, particularly in reading, which was agony for him. And his physical prowess put him in another league on the playground. The other children wouldn't let him play, so he had become an excellent surfer. And by now the truth was out. There had been a particularly distressing article in People magazine, The Modern Family, which said, "The most up-to-date family is no longer a same-sex family, or a blended family, or an interracial family. That's all so last century," says Tracy Kendall, and she should know, because the Kendall family of La Jolla, California, is transgenic and interspecies, creating more excitement in the household than a barrel of monkeys. Henry had been called to testify before Congress, which he found a peculiar experience. The congressmen spoke to the cameras for 2 hours, then they got up and left, pleading urgent business elsewhere. Then the witnesses spoke for 6 minutes each, but there were no congressmen there to hear their remarks. Later, the congressmen all announced they would soon deliver major speeches on the subject of transgenic creation. Henry was named Scientist of the Year by the Society for Libertarian Biology. Jeremy Rifkin called him a war criminal. He had been excoriated by the National Council of Churches. The Pope excommunicated him, only later to discover that he wasn't Catholic. They had the wrong Henry Kendall. The NIH criticized his work, but the replacement for Robert Bellarmino as head of genetics was William Gladstone, and he was much more open-minded and less self-aggrandizing than Bellarmino had been. Henry now traveled continuously, lecturing about transgenic techniques at university seminars around the country. He was the subject of intense controversy. The Reverend Billy John Harker of Tennessee called him Satan incarnate. Bill Mayer, noted left-wing reactionary, published a long and much-discussed article in the New York Review of Books entitled Banished from Eden, Why We Must Prevent Transgenic Travesties. The article failed to mention that transgenic animals had been in existence for 2 decades already. Dogs, cats, bacteria, mice, sheep, and cattle had all been created. When a senior NIH scientist was asked about the article, he coughed and said, "What's the New York Review?" Lynn Kendall ran the Transgenic Times website, which detailed the daily life of Dave, Gerard, and her fully human children, Jamie and Tracy. After a year in La Jolla, Gerard began to make dial tone sounds. He had done it before, but the tones were mysterious to the Kendalls. Evidently, they were the tones of a foreign telephone exchange, but they failed to identify which country. "Where did you come from, Gerard?" they would ask. "I can't sleep a wink anymore, ever since you first walked out the door." He had become enamored of American country music. "All you ever do is bring me down."
"What country, Gerard?"
To that, they never received an answer. He spoke some French, and he often talked with a British accent. They assumed he was European. Then one day, one of Henry's graduate students from France was having dinner at their house, and he heard Gerard's tones.
"My God," he said, "I know what he is doing."
He listened for a moment.
"There is no city code," he said, "but otherwise, let's try."
He pulled out his own cell phone and began to key in numbers.
"Do it again, Gerard."
Gerard repeated the tones.
"And again?"
"Life is a book. You've got to read it," Gerard sang. "Life is a story, and you've got to tell it."
"I know this song,"
the graduate student said.
"What is it?"
Henry said.
"It's Eurovision. Gerard, the tones."
Eventually, Gerard did the dial tones. The graduate student placed the call. His first guess was to try Paris. A woman answered the phone. He said in French,
"Excuse me, but do you know of a gray parrot who is named Gerard?"
The woman began to cry.
"Let me speak to him," she said. "Is he all right?"
"He is fine."
They held the phone by Gerard's perch, and he listened to the woman's voice. His head bobbed excitedly. Then he said,
"Is this where you live? Oh, mother's going to love it here."
Gail Bond arrived to visit a few days later. She stayed a week and then returned alone. Gerard, it seemed, wanted to stay. For days afterward, he sang,
"Well, baby used to stay out all night long. She made me cry. She done me wrong. She hurt my eyes open. That's no lie. Tables turn, and now her turn to cry. Because I used to love her, but it's all over now."
All in all, things were working out much better than anyone expected. The family was busy, but everyone got along. There were only 2 worrisome trends. Henry noticed that Dave had developed a few gray hairs around his muzzle, so it was possible that Dave, like most other transgenics, might die earlier than usual. And one autumn day, while Dave was walking with Henry at the county fair, holding Henry's hand, a farmer in overalls came up and said,
"I'd like to get me one of them to work on my farm."
That gave Henry a chill. Author's note. At the end of my research for this book, I arrived at the following conclusions. 1. Stop patenting genes. Gene patents might have looked reasonable 20 years ago, but the field has changed in ways nobody could have predicted. Today we have plenty of evidence that gene patents are unnecessary, unwise, and harmful. There is great confusion about gene patents. Many observers conflate a call to end gene patents with anti-capitalist and anti-private property sentiments. It is nothing of the sort. It is perfectly reasonable for industry to seek a mechanism that will ensure a profit on productive investment. Such a mechanism implies a restriction on competition involving a created product. However, such protection does not imply that genes themselves should be patented. On the contrary, gene patents contradict long-established traditions of intellectual property protection. First, genes are facts of nature. Like gravity, sunlight, and leaves on trees, genes exist in the natural world. Facts of nature can't be owned. You can own a test for a gene or a drug that affects a gene, but not the gene itself. You can own a treatment for a disease, but not the disease itself. Gene patents break that fundamental rule. Of course, one can argue about what's a fact of nature, and there are people paid to do that, but here's a simple test. If something exists for millions of years before the arrival of Homo sapiens on Earth, it's a fact of nature. To argue that a gene is in any way a human invention is absurd. To grant a gene patent is like granting a patent on iron or carbon. Because it's a patent on a fact of nature, a gene patent becomes an undeserved monopoly. Ordinarily, patent protection enables me to protect my invention, but encourages others to make their own versions. My iPod doesn't prevent you from making a digital audio player. My patented mousetrap is wood, but your titanium mousetrap is allowed. This is not what happens with gene patents. The patent consists of pure information already existing in nature. Because there has been no invention, no one can innovate any other use of the patent without violating the patent itself, so further innovation is closed. It's like allowing somebody to patent noses. You couldn't make eyeglasses, Kleenex, nasal sprays, masks, makeup, or perfume because they all rely on some aspect of noses. You could put suntan lotion on your body, but not on your nose, because any modification of your nose would violate the patent on noses. Chefs could be sued for making fragrant dishes unless they paid the nose royalty, and so on. Of course, we would all agree that a patent on noses is absurd. If everyone has one, how can anyone own it? Gene patents are absurd for the same reason. It takes little imagination to see that monopolistic patenting inhibits creation and productivity. If the creator of Auguste Dupin could own all fictional detectives, we would never have had Sherlock Holmes, Sam Spade, Philip Marlowe, Miss Marple, Inspector McGray, Peter Wimsey, Hercule Poirot, Mike Hammer, or J.J. Gittes, to name just a few. This rich heritage of invention would be denied us by a patenting error. Yet that is exactly the error in patenting genes. Gene patents are bad public policy. We have ample evidence that they hurt patient care and suppress research. When Myriad patented two breast cancer genes, they charged nearly $3,000 for the test, even though the cost to create a gene test is nothing like the cost to develop a drug. Not surprisingly, the European Patent Office revoked that patent on a technicality. The Canadian government announced that it would conduct gene tests without paying for the patent. Some years ago, the owner of the gene for Canavan disease refused to make the test widely available.
even though families who had suffered with the disease had contributed time, money, and tissues to get the gene identified. Now those same families could not afford the test. That is an outrage, but it is far from the most dangerous consequence of gene patents. In its heyday, research on SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, was inhibited because scientists were unsure who owned the genome. Three simultaneous patent claims had been filed. As a result, research on SARS wasn't as vigorous as it might have been. That should scare every sensible person. Here was a contagious disease with a 10% death rate that had spread to 24 countries around the world. Yet scientific research to combat the disease was inhibited because of patent fears. At the moment, hepatitis C, HIV, Haemophilus influenza, and various diabetes genes are all owned by some entity. They shouldn't be. Nobody should own a disease. If gene patents are ended, we can expect screams of outrage and threats that business will abandon research, that companies will go bankrupt, that health care will suffer and the public will die. But it is more likely that an end to gene patents will be phenomenally liberating to everyone and will result in a burst of new products for the public. 2. Establish clear guidelines for the use of human tissues. Human tissue collections are increasingly important to medical research and increasingly valuable. Appropriate federal regulations to manage tissue banks already exists, but courts have ignored federal rules. Historically, the courts have decided questions about human tissues based on existing property law. In general, they have ruled that once your tissue leaves your body, you no longer maintain any rights to it. They analogize tissues to, say, the donation of a book to a library. But people have a strong feeling of ownership about their bodies, and that feeling will never be abrogated by a mere legal technicality. Therefore, we need new, clear, emphatic legislation. Why do we need legislation? Consider a recent court ruling on the case of Dr. William Catalona. This eminent prostate cancer physician assembled a collection of tissue samples from his patients so he could work on the disease. When Dr. Catalona moved to another university, he tried to take the tissues with him. Washington University refused, saying that it owned the tissues. The judge upheld the university, citing such trivial facts as some of the releases being printed on Washington University's stationery. Patients are now understandably outraged. They believed they were giving their tissues to a beloved doctor, not a shadowy university lurking in the background. They thought they were giving tissues specifically for prostate cancer research, not for any use, which the university now claims the right to do. The notion that once you part with your tissue, you no longer have any rights is absurd. Consider this. Under present law, if somebody takes my picture, I have rights forever in the use of that photo. 20 years later, if somebody publishes it or puts it in an advertisement, I still have rights. But if somebody takes my tissue, part of my physical body, I have no rights. This means I have more rights over my image than I have over the actual tissues of my body. The required legislation should ensure that patients have control over their tissues. I donate my tissues for a purpose, and that purpose only. If later someone wants to use them for another purpose, they need my permission again. If they can't get permission, they can't use my tissues. Such a rule fulfills an important emotional need, but it also acknowledges that there may be significant legal and religious reasons why I do not want my tissue used for another purpose. We should not fear that such regulations will inhibit research. After all, the National Institutes of Health seems to be able to conduct research while following these guidelines.
nor should we accept the argument that these rules impose an onerous burden. If a magazine can notify you that your subscription has run out, a university can notify you if they want to use your tissues for a new purpose. 3. Pass laws to ensure that data about gene testing is made public. New legislation is needed if the FDA is to publish adverse results from gene therapy trials. At the moment, it cannot do so. In the past, some researchers have tried to prevent the reporting of patient deaths, claiming that such deaths were a trade secret. The public is increasingly aware of defects in the systems we use to report medical data. Research data has not been made available for other scientists to inspect. Full disclosure has not been required. Genuinely independent verification of findings is rare. The result is a public exposed to untold unknown hazards. Bias in published studies has become a bad joke. Psychiatrist John Davis looked at the trials funded by pharmaceutical companies in competition for the most effective of 5 different antipsychotic drugs. He found that 90% of the time, the drug manufactured by the company sponsoring, paying for the study, was judged superior to the others. Whoever paid for the study had the best drug. This should not be news. Review studies conducted by those who have a financial or other interest in the outcome are not reliable because they are inherently biased. That fact should be addressed by an information system that does not permit biased testing and takes steps to ensure that it does not occur. Yet gross bias remains far too common in medicine and in certain other areas of high-stakes science as well. Government should take action. In the long run, there is no constituency for bad information. In the short run, all sorts of groups want to bend the facts their way, and they do not hesitate to call their senators Democratic or Republican. This will continue until the public demands a change. 4. Avoid bans on research. Various groups of different political persuasions want to ban some aspect of genetic research. I agree that certain research ought not to be pursued, at least not now, but as a practical matter, I oppose bans on research and technology. Bans can't be enforced. I don't know why we have not learned this lesson. From prohibition to the war on drugs, we repeatedly indulge the fantasy that behavior can be banned. Invariably, we fail. And in a global economy, bans take on other meanings. Even if you stop research in one country, it still goes on in Shanghai. So what have you accomplished? Of course, hope springs eternal, and fantasies never die. Various groups imagine they can negotiate a global ban on certain research. But to the best of my knowledge, there has never been a successful global ban on anything. Genetic research is unlikely to be the first. 5. Rescind the Bayh-Dole Act. In 1980, Congress decided that the discoveries made within universities were not being made widely available to benefit the public. To move things along, it passed a law permitting university researchers to sell their discoveries for their own profit, even when that research had been funded by taxpayer money. As a result of this legislation, most science professors now have corporate ties, either to companies they have started or to other biotech companies. 30 years ago, there was a distinct difference in approach between university research and that of private industry. Today, the distinction is blurred or absent. 30 years ago, disinterested scientists were available to discuss any subject affecting the public. Now, scientists have personal interests that influence their judgment. Academic institutions have changed in unexpected ways. The original Bayh-Dole legislation recognized that universities were not commercial entities and encouraged them to make their research available to organizations that were. But today, universities attempt to maximize profits by conducting more and more commercial work themselves, thus making their products more valuable to them when they are finally licensed. For example, if universities think they have a new drug, they will do the FDA testing themselves, and so on. Thus, Bayh-Dole has paradoxically increased the commercial focus of the university. Many observers judge the effect of this legislation to be corrupting and destructive to universities as institutions of learning. Bayh-Dole was always of uncertain benefit to the American taxpayers, who became, through their government, uniquely generous investors. Taxpayers finance research, but when it bears fruit, the researchers sell it for their own institutional and personal gain, after which the drug is sold back to the taxpayers. Consumers thus pay top dollar for a drug they helped finance. Ordinarily, when a venture capitalist invests in research, he or she expects a significant return on investment. The American taxpayer gets no return at all. The Bayh-Dole legislation anticipated that the public would receive a flood of marvelous life-saving therapies such that the investment strategy would be justified, but that hasn't happened. Instead, the drawbacks far outweigh the benefits. Secrecy now pervades research and hampers medical progress. Universities that once provided a scholarly haven from the world are now commercialized. The haven is gone. Scientists who once felt a humanitarian calling have become businessmen concerned with profit and loss. The life of the mind is a notion as quaint as the whalebone corset. All these trends were perfectly clear to observers 15 years ago. No one paid much attention back then. Now the problems are becoming clear to everyone. A good first step toward restoring the balance between academia and corporations will be to repeal Bayh-Dole legislation.
I am Jonathan Burnham, publisher of HarperCollins, and I'm here interviewing best-selling author Michael Crichton about his new novel, Next. Michael, as with many of your other novels, Next is a vivid dramatization of what can happen when cutting-edge science goes a little too far. Is Next a cautionary tale?
Well, I think it is in the sense that many of the books are. But for me, what's different about this book is that so much of it is real, or so much of it is very thinly disguised versions of actual events that have occurred. Genetics, which is the subject of the book, has advanced extraordinarily rapidly in the last 15 years or so. And sometimes in directions that many people are troubled about or disapprove of. And so it's a very interesting and hot, contentious area.
And have you been tracking the science of genetics for the last 15 years, watching it, seeing what's going on, and building a portfolio?
Actually, you know, it's odd. I was very interested in it at the time of Jurassic Park, which now, to my astonishment, is 15 years ago. And I lost track of it a bit, so that to return is to have this odd sense of coming into a world where so many things that were fictional 15 years ago are now actually taking place.
You've chosen a very interesting and I think new form for this novel, which is to break down the conventional narrative into many different stories, some of which overlap, some of which are self-contained, and others which move forward and become the principal themes of the book. How did you conceive of this book in formal terms?
Well, I think there were two considerations that I had. One was that I was unable to overlook the structure of the genome as we're now starting to understand it, and how individual genes interact with other genes or may seem to be silent, or we don't really know what they do, or sometimes they're repetitions that are not clear to us. And it struck me as an interesting idea to try and organize the novel in that way, even though it's not what one ordinarily does. The second thing that was driving me was the notion that there are a great many stories of interest in this area, and they're all quite different in terms of the legal and ethical problems that are raised in the field. So I wanted to do a number of different stories.
Next poses a large number of ethical issues to the reader. Do you personally have a strong position on these issues?
Well, I do on some and not on others. I think the feeling in general that I have is that we have too little information, and the impulse in some quarters to ban things or to prevent research or curtail it seems to me ill-advised and also not very practical. Whatever research isn't done in the United States will be done in Shanghai, and so what exactly is being accomplished? I do think there are some things that have been done in a business sense which are tremendously bad and dangerous and inappropriate, and among those are the patenting of genes. You know, we have within our bodies, for the most part, identical genes, and many of these genes are millions or even billions of years old. They're found in other animals, they're found in microorganisms, and yet they're being patented now, and diseases are being patented. Hepatitis C is owned by somebody. Haemophilus influenza is owned by somebody. The gene for insulin is owned. This seems to me to be very wrong on a number of levels, and I hope that that this will be changed and the book may be influential in starting a discussion.
You've written about many frightening areas of science in your novels. How does genetics rate in the large field that you've covered in terms of the elements of fear connected to reality that are built into it?
As a person, I think I am myself not very fearful, and it may be that I get out all these fears in my work. The first sort of genetics book that I did that addressed any of these things was Jurassic Park, and that was, of course, entirely fiction. What's happened at this point is that many of these possibilities are real. And so you see, because of the structure and the way that things are being done, when you hear, for example, that scientists were reluctant to study SARS, you know, the severe acute respiratory syndrome that was spreading across the world, a disease that had a 10% fatality and was suddenly in 24 countries, and scientists hesitated to study it because there was a conflict over who would own the genome, who would get the patent. That's very scary, you know, that business interests might put us all at risk for a pandemic. It's kind of insane.
How do you keep abreast of new developments in science?
But for the most part, it's simply reading. I do occasionally visit laboratories, but not very often, and there's sort of two reasons for it. One is that when one goes to an individual laboratory, one spends time with someone who has a particular strong interest in a very narrow area, which usually is not my area of interest. But the other thing is that it's to read is the equivalent of, you know, talking to people on the telephone. It's just simply much faster. It's a much quicker way, so... And the journals stack up in my office, and I go through them as best I can.
Your first goal as a writer, I'm sure, is to entertain, and you've done that brilliantly in this book. But in terms of asking readers to think about the issues that you're exploring, what do you want the reader to take away from next after they've finished it?
Well, I think what my experience was in working on this was a kind of combination of anxiety and excitement, the possibility of really wonderful things that might happen. The possibility that, for example, certain genetic diseases may actually be cured. And the people who previously either were certain to die or could only be treated in fairly unsatisfactory ways, there is now the likelihood that you will be able to inject the gene and that person is cured. That's quite extraordinary. And there are many other examples of new cancer treatments and other things that are just amazing. And then at the other side, there is this connection of law and business and academia, which is very distressing in the directions that it's going, and it involves a tremendous amount of secrecy. It involves a tremendous direction, which I think is against the public interest and which really ought to distress and frighten people.
If you were in a position to create legislation, how would you begin to rein in the bad science, the combination of science, business, and academics moving in the wrong direction as you see it?
I think there are actually three or four things that would really transform the field. The first thing that I would do is I would make the testing of genes for medical diagnosis completely legal, irrespective of patents. And I think that would do a great public service and also would oblige scientists to start to look at the patenting business in a different way. The second thing that I would do is I would require universities to follow federal guidelines for use of tissues in research. Federal guidelines are excellent. They give people a tremendous amount of control over the tissues that they donate. Many universities, institutions of higher learning are trying to break these rules, trying to go in another direction. They ought not to be allowed to. And I would change that. The third thing I would do is I would make sure that people got the information that they needed to make informed decisions. There are some situations now where patients have died from gene therapy, and the institutions involved have said that they don't want the deaths reported because they're a trade secret. This is so insane that, yeah. that it's that the mind boggles. This, whatever legislation is needed to stop that, we ought to do. And the final thing is that in 1980, there was a law passed that was called Bayh-Dole, a bipartisan law that enabled universities to sell their products to industry. And it was well-intentioned, but it has had the effect of creating this gigantic commercial consolation within universities. It's very damaging, and so I would reverse that law.
In spite of the serious message of the book and the profound issues you're tackling, there's a lot of fun in this book. There are many jokes, there are many very amusing passages and stories, and there are a number of ideas, concepts that perhaps are true or perhaps are fictional. Is there anything in the book that you would like to be real that perhaps isn't real that would improve your life?
Interesting question. I don't know how to answer that. I guess what I feel is that whatever I might imagine is probably right around the corner anyway.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for this interview, and we are sure this book is going to be a huge success.
Thank you, Jonathan. Right.
This recording was produced and directed by Rick Harris. It was recorded at Harper Audio Studios by Richard Romaniello and Sharon Matlin. It was edited by Valerie Ratron and mixed and mastered by Lance Neal. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.